Welcome to the fourth episode of The First Cut. Today I am joined by Dr. Aziza Sese, GP, educator, creator, someone who seems to be everywhere all at once. So welcome.
Hi, Sophia. I'm so happy to be here.
And happy to have you. So the first time that I heard your work was over on YouTube, where you spoke about how powerful language can be, especially for women's health, but in shaping consultations, and the words we avoid are often the ones that we most need to say. I think the entry to your TED talk, bringing out a plush vulva, well, that moment really stayed with me, and it was really brilliant and bold and just summed up the fact that we're scared to talk about these things that literally half the population has. So why do you think it's still hard for people, even doctors sometimes, to talk about something so common? And why do you think that is?
Yes, absolutely. And I have my vulva. I'm always carrying it around. So whether this is a video or just or audio, know that the vulva is here. So I carry around two, one that I was born with and this crochet one. But no, I hear you. Yes, I think quite a few people say it's quite bold, and it's, someone said I'm audacious. But I think that it's just something that we need to normalize, and we just need to get over it at the end of the day. Like you said, the 51% of the population has it. And we should try and normalize the words, because they're not bad words. And you're absolutely right. It's not just the general public. It's also some healthcare professionals. And I think sometimes why perhaps, and I'm not making excuses, but why perhaps they say things like down there, or what's the other word that they say? Your bits, or really, I think that part of why nether regions, front bottom, all the euphemisms. And I think that partly why they use those maybe is because they're not sure whether the patients might feel offended, which shouldn't be the case. At the end of the day, if we don't show any shame or embarrassment around it, then that helps for them not to feel shame and embarrassment, particularly if they already had that in them. That just exacerbates it, doesn't it? But I think that the older generation, certainly sometimes they are taken aback by the words, because for the longest time it was seen as negative, derogatory, and just bad, really.
So like many connotations attached to it, hugely.
And do you think there was a specific moment, perhaps, that you realised your voice on these topics needed to be taken outside of the clinic and more into the public space?
Yeah, there are multiple different moments, but one that I often share, and this was actually before I properly went onto the public space, but this is when I realized how bad the situation is. And it's something so simple. I had a South Asian Muslim patient who came to see me, and she saw me about something else, but because we had a rapport and she felt comfortable talking to me, she opened up about symptoms that she'd had for a very, very long time. And when we discussed it, it sounded like, okay, this is probably thrush. You know, gave her the treatment and she went on her way. But she actually booked a review appointment, not because she had any other issues, but just to thank me. That's how grateful she was. Like, oh my God, you gave me my life back. Thank you so much. And it was like this really big, grand deal when all I did was give her antifungals, which now you can just get over the counter. So it's something as simple as that, where people don't come forward about their issues. And the thing is, what's really sad is I am still seeing this to this day. I'm still having women coming to me about their issues. Maybe they'll say that they're having issues somewhere else because they're too ashamed to write about the actual problem. And when they come to see me, it's like, actually, I've had this for like a month and I was too embarrassed. Why, you know, it shouldn't be that way. And there's so many women who are suffering in silence, so many who are dealing with issues that they shouldn't be just coping with or toughing it out, as President Trump recently said when he was talking about pregnancy and paracetamol. We don't have to tough it out. And it's not a plight that we have to deal with just because we are women and we have gynecological anatomy. We need to be able to speak up and get our symptoms checked. And part of why I'm really passionate about this is there's so many who are getting diagnosed late with conditions that had they been diagnosed earlier, their outcomes would have been completely different. And this is the case for gynecological cancer, for instance. You know, I know of stories of people who've had bleeding after menopause and they didn't think that it was anything serious, or they were too embarrassed again to come forward about that. And then sadly, they get diagnosed with womb cancer late. So it's that kind of thing that we need to really, really change, both culturally, through the population, and opening up the conversation, because there are, again, there's the traditions that come into play, all of that, which then impacts the lives of so many. It is literally costing lives.
And when you think about something like thrush that can be so easily cured, and you think about not even people not being diagnosed, but endometriosis being underdiagnosed hugely with in the female population. So that's why, again, I think what you're doing is so important. But
thank you.
As a GP educator and a creator, where would you say you draw the line between private consultation and a public health message?
I mean, obviously, I'm bound by confidentiality, so I can never share personal information. I can't share the exact specifics of things. And that, I hope, as a medical student, you learn that too. But where I'm able to shape, at the end of the day, the reason I feel like I can speak publicly and I can share the realities is because I am seeing it within my clinics. You know, I'm not just making up stories or, oh, this is what it potentially is technically through research, which is equally as important. But it's so important to give that clinical expertise and knowledge and what you see on a day-to-day, because that at the end of the day is the reality that so many are facing. So absolutely, I do not share private health information, but I will share stories similar to what I have seen, because you know, one story that I'm telling you, I've probably seen a similar case 100 times, do you know what I mean? So at the end of the day, these are stories I think are really relatable. For instance, there are some stories that I share and someone's like, oh my God, you are describing me, literally. Yeah. So when you, just because you touched on endometriosis, yeah, if we talk about endometriosis, PCOS, fibroids, PMDD, often conditions that are usually forgotten, not many people talk about them. And endometriosis is getting definitely more public awareness, which is great. And we need the same for all the other conditions as well, because ultimately you have so many women who are getting diagnosed late or getting misdiagnosed, or actually they have symptoms and they don't realize that those symptoms aren't normal. So whenever I'm talking about periods, and I feel like I say this all the time, but every single time I've said it, there's always someone who said, I had no idea, that's not normal. So having really heavy periods where you're bleeding through your clothes, or you're passing clots bigger than a 10p coin, or you're having to change your period products every hour, or you're bleeding through your clothes, you are bleeding on your bed, so you're putting a towel at night on your bed sheet because you know that you're going to bleed through. All of those are not normal. If you're bleeding so much that it's causing symptoms of anemia, which is headaches, dizziness, shortness of breath, tiredness, pica, which is where you start to eat paper and cardboard, a symptom of anemia or iron deficiency. If you have any of those, that's not normal. If your periods are really painful, that you're vomiting, that it's stopping you from going to school, stopping you from going to work, doing your day-to-day activity, and so on and so forth, that's not normal. And recently, I mean, the stat that really hit me, I mean, we've known this for a while, but the more you hear something, you're like, that's crazy, especially I have a daughter who's quite sporty. You know, they say that 1 in 2 girls give up sports because of their periods. That shouldn't be the case. Periods shouldn't be the reason that it's deterring women from doing sports and playing activities. So there's so much that is the reason why I'm really passionate about what I'm doing.
Yeah, and it's almost a bit of journalism that you're doing is what I mean from your clinics as well. You're seeing what's happening and then you're translating that into a story that people can actually absorb and understand and really resonate with.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Across the whole of the UK. So you've represented the UK at the UN Women Commission. What lessons about gender equality and health could the UK learn from other countries, or vice versa?
Oh, wow. Oh, what a question. Oh, my goodness.
Monday morning.
Do you know what? One thing is clear. Gender equality is still lacking throughout the world. There is still a lot of work that needs to be done to improve the current situation that we are in. There are certain countries that are doing better than others. And the UK, I believe, where we're leading is in the menopause awareness. So I think the UK is one of the first places that started shouting about menopause and the impact and the realities and the push and the need for more awareness, more information, more treatment options. So we were one of the first to, you know, in the UK, I think it was last year that they made it so your HRT prescriptions, you only needed to pay for two prescriptions essentially for a full year, which is great. And then only this year, like it was last month, they announced that now during the NHS health checks, which you get invited to between the ages of 40 to 74, they will ask questions about menopause. And the reason being is that menopausal symptoms, many women don't realize that a lot of the symptoms that they're getting is to do with menopause, and it's only until quite late. And also we know that I don't want to use the word treatment, but earlier support for menopause is helpful in the long term, because that dip in our estrogen has long-term negative effects on our bones, our brain health, our heart health, and so on. So the earlier we get support, the better. In terms of the gender health equity or gender equity, we still have a lot of work to do. I think what's really beautiful is that the conversations are being held and there is better improvement. Mm-hmm. Certain parts of the world, we have gone backwards, sadly, because of the leaders in the space. But I believe that there's hope, because there's so many of us who are advocating, who are pushing and wanting change. We're not just shouting about it. We're actually actively doing things to evoke change.
I think that's really important what you were saying about holding those conversations, because sometimes it feels like I'm losing all faith when you hear in America how they've reverted laws and they found loopholes and things are just, you think, what is going on? But we're back in Handmaid's Tale type of times. Yeah. But you're right in the sense that we have people doing things now. And in this new age of AI and everything as well, it can be really difficult in the digital health. So being part of YouTube, having done TED Talks and really being in that space, what do you think is the biggest challenge in making credible medicine watchable in the age of algorithms?
That's a million-dollar question. So it's a bit difficult, right, to be in this space sometimes. And this is me being completely transparent when we talk about algorithms, because I'm not in control of the algorithms. And I just sometimes you just post and hope for the best nowadays. The reason being, I do a lot of women's health. I share a lot of, you know, vulvas and I speak about vaginas and the taboo topics. That is not very attractive to the algorithm. And in fact, I recently had, this is something I get a lot, and not just me, a lot of women's health advocates get this on their posts. So I had a sensitivity cover put on a post where I was showing how to check your vulva using a crochet vulva, because they said that some people might find the content upsetting. And that really bothered me, because, you know, I'm sure you scroll through social media and there's some really explicit pornographic content, and they don't put covers on that. And it's not upsetting to other people, but it almost feels like when you share educational videos that can empower women, that's not okay. But everything else that's hypersexualized is okay. That status quo. So yeah, it's really hard to get the right balance. And the algorithm is really annoying in that regard. But what's helpful is when you get support from others. So we can combat the algorithm if more of us engage and reshare and repost and comment on these sort of content, because then the algorithm is like, oh, actually maybe it is good, let's go back to trying to post this and share this amongst more people. So yeah,
we're trying to be onto something.
So we are a little bit a slave to the algorithm, but I would just say, like, we shouldn't give up. I mean, there are times where I feel like, ugh, this is so annoying, I want this to reach more people. But we also get stuck in that vanity metrics. You kind of get obsessed with the glitz and the glam and the numbers, and you're like, oh my God, I need this to have at least 1,000, 2,000, hundreds of thousands, millions of views, because then that will make more of an impact. But actually, it takes one view and one person whose life changes. And I've had a lot of comments and messages from people saying, you know, thank you so much, actually, because of your video, this has happened, or you saved my life, blah, blah, blah. All of those things, which is really great. And it's only a couple of videos. So we never know who's watching. and we shouldn't get sucked into that. And what's really important is remembering why we've started to do this. So I started to make sure that there is evidence-based, credible health information out there and tackle the misinformation, because there's a lot, and especially to do with women's health. There, women are being exploited, sadly, because we're desperate. We're really desperate, particularly if you have any of those conditions where we don't have a cure as yet. So there's a lot, but I think remembering the why, pushing forward, and just knowing that the videos can positively change even one life, that's more than enough.
And I think what you were saying about the algorithms almost speaks to kind of the problems that we're having with our cultural norms in this country and around the world as well, being that people need access to this information because it's health information and it's about a body part that you have. But we're censoring these things. We're censoring it, education. But we're still able to show women in a light that is hypersexualized, and that's seemingly okay. So, yeah. So how do you balance visibility, showing who's in the room with actually changing these systems that decide who gets to be there?
I don't really have much control when it comes to visibility, but one thing that I am really passionate about is bringing people with me and also supporting those who are starting up, because you just never know what impact they will make one day. So when you sent me a message on Instagram, oh, I have this podcast, I'm like, oh, she's a fourth-year medical student, let me support her, because you are basically the leader of tomorrow. And I don't know who's going to listen to this and how it'll impact them, but I'm hopeful that it will make such a massive difference. So for me, what's most important is ensuring that whilst I'm in this space, I'm also encouraging and bringing others with me, and also showing them that it's possible for them to do the same. You don't have to be anything massive. You don't have to have everything ready to be ready. Sometimes I feel like we are detriment to ourselves, or we stop our own opportunities because we want to be the best. We want to prepare for, you know, all of the possibilities, when actually just share the videos. Like a lot of what I started doing from the very beginning was just doing it. It wasn't even planned. On the opportunities that I've gotten have come organically. I've just been consistent, thankfully. I haven't necessarily needed to buy expensive equipment and also the other thing that I did, which you've done, is I've reached out to people, because the answer is always no if you don't reach out. So reaching out, putting things out there, that's your portfolio. I've had amazing opportunities because people have had the opportunity to look at my content and see what I'm already like. So that's like a portfolio there. If someone's like, oh, I think Aziza is good, they can look at all my socials and they'll see what I'm like. And then actually, I think she'll be a good fit without having to interview me or anything like that. That's there. So yeah, I feel like I've just gone around a tangent, but ultimately my point is that in terms of visibility, I can't control it. Like we spoke about the algorithm, what I can control is being present, being there so people can see me. I'm having the content ready and posted and interacting with others, collaborating. I'm very big on collaborating and bringing people along with me. But most importantly, representation. So I'm a Black woman, and we don't see that much of us on the screen. We're seeing more, much more than before. But I want a young girl, so I have a daughter. I want a young girl to see me and see themselves in me and know that they can do it too, you know?
You got to get in the arena if you ever want to do anything. I think people get caught in that cycle of having ideas, things that they want to pursue, and it's so easy to plan and plan and plan, but it's never going to be perfect. You're never going to be in that incredible space, and things aren't going to really fall on your lap. So yeah, you kind of bit in the bullet there, and I think that's so important to tell people to do, and not to tell people to feel like they can't because of who they are or anything else. So when you started working as a GP, were you doing the social media alongside it, or when did that start?
No. Really quickly, before I answer that question, I wanted to say perfection is so overrated, by the way, because I have found that the moment I let go and I was just myself, and I can be a bit of a klutz. I'm a bit clumsy and silly, and I laugh, and, you know, I'm me. the moment I was more me was the moment, and I let go of that perfection or that ideology that I was, as a doctor, I'm supposed to show myself as this, you know, perfect professional who's really stern, or it's just professional. I felt like I had to portray myself in a certain way. But the moment I let go of that, and that was even, that was an accident. It was a day where I was just, I was over it. I had stuff happening in my life, and I forgot to be professional. And that was the day that I had the most compliments. And I realized, oh, that's because I was being me. So honestly, get over all of those expectations that we sometimes put on ourselves, but we think that society puts on us too, and just be yourself. And you'd be surprised how much more likable you are, because it's so much easier to be yourself than to be what you think others think you should be.
On that point, I think doctors, a lot of the time there's a perception that you're very stern and perfect and you diagnose this, you know everything. But I think that's very much how we used to perceive doctors, and they used to see them as, this is a patient, this is your ailment, you take it. And we've even had things with saying, oh, our patient's compliant, but we're not even trying to say that anymore. So it's two people, and you know, you're seeing someone in a very vulnerable state, and to just come at them on a human level is kind of the most important thing.
And that's it. It's the human level. And even as doctors, we are human. We are human beings first. We're human beings, and then you add on all the layers. And I think if we remember that aspect, then we do that with our patients as well. That makes us, that just builds the best connection. I love hearing that from you as a fourth year medical student, as a future doctor. Do not change that aspect. You need to be human. And it is all about that shared management plan, no longer paternalistic medicine at the end of the day. And if you're not explaining things to the patient, they won't do it. You have to speak to them at their level, and not dictate things to them, and just state the facts. And that's what I found has been really helpful. But in answer to your question, I was practicing as a GP for, I think, 6 or 7 years before I started doing my social media. 6 years, yeah, before I started doing social media. So it was just one of those things. And it happened because during lockdown, my aunt called me because, you know, not many people were going to the doctors. It was lockdown and everyone was scared to come and see GPs because they were worried they were going to catch COVID. And she called me and she said, oh, guess what? I was like, what? My blood pressure is normal. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. She's like, so I stopped taking my blood pressure tablets. And I was like, oh my God, no. So she didn't know the basics. And I realized that that's something a lot of people don't know. So I started doing Zoom talks just for my local community. I was already doing talks in my local community in person, but obviously I couldn't do that with due to lockdown. So instead I did it through Zoom, and it was just my way of giving back. I was doing that every fortnight. And then I couldn't do it as much because I got pregnant, and I had really bad pregnancy symptoms. So instead, I started making my short videos that you see, these short engaging videos, which really took off, and a lot of people found them relatable and helpful. So that's
the demand for it, yeah.
From there, it's just built through there, from, you know, from the Zooms to saving my recordings on YouTube to the videos that I created to working with different charity organizations, and then working with NHS England, the Department of Health and Social Care, the World Health Organizations, all these places. It all came from this one act that I just wanted to give back. And now, you know, I've been fortunate to be on, you know, BBC a few times, and been on multiple radio shows, podcasts, and written articles for some really great magazines and news articles and so on and so forth. So I guess what I'm trying to say in all this is it started with one act that was pure, and it's led to all of these incredible opportunity. And for me to continue as I am, I always go back to that one act. I started this because I was like, they don't know the basics. I want them to know the basics. And that's why I haven't stopped. So, yeah.
And I think a lot of people are glad that you haven't stopped. And it's important, I think, coming back to that kind of purpose of why you're doing things. And that helps when you get all this noise around the algorithm or the state, because there's always going to be something. We're never going to be able to fix everything, because that's just impossible. But you mentioned the future and the future generations of doctors earlier being kind of a very important thing. So If you were redesigning medicine from scratch, what's the first thing you'd change? And when you imagine healthcare maybe 10 years from now, what would success look like for you?
Okay, so there are loads of things that I would change. I mean, one thing I really want to change is the importance of women's health education. I feel like that needs to be done better from med school, ultimately from med school onwards. I would want us to spend a bit more time in the interpersonal skills. The reason being is you just hear the same stories. I didn't feel listened to by my doctor. I felt like I was dismissed and they didn't take my symptoms seriously. And then obviously you have the situations where diagnoses are being made late. I feel like if we spent just that little bit more time with our med students, teaching them that interpersonal skills, just being human, as we've spoken about, being able to relate to a patient and taking off that hat of I'm medical, and that's all I'm going to see you as. You're my patient. I think remembering that they are, yes, they're patients, but they're people first, that could really skew things, and it could definitely benefit the whole population, but especially women, because they're the ones, or we, I am a woman too, we are the ones who feel let down the most when it comes to healthcare. And the moment that we improve that in med school, then that could change. Research, there's so many other things I want to say in terms of that. But if I was to go back to med school, I would spend a bit more time on that. Yes, the education and the clinical knowledge is absolutely paramount, because at the end of the day, this is the difference between life and death. We have our patients' lives in our hand. But that can make such a massive difference. Just listening, being able to be human with our patients. And I've found personally that that has changed the trajectory of my interactions with patients, and also just how they feel. Sometimes patients don't even come in necessarily with ailments. They just want to be listened to, honestly. And I've seen the difference that makes. It's hard. It's really hard in the NHS when we don't have enough time, especially as GPs, where you have 10-minute consultations, but it helps.
I think hugely listening to patients when they gave a lot of patients after seeing doctors a scorecard and said, did they think this was a good doctor, a bad doctor? The thing that came up time and time again wasn't how much the doctor knew about the anatomy of the body or how white their coat was, whatever we're talking about. It was how much they listened to the patient, to what they were saying, how if just having your ears open and having someone, be able to express what they're feeling, which is kind of the most intimate things, your own health. So hugely listening to people and research as well, would you say?
Absolutely. Research in women's health, because there's only 1 to 2% when we remove cancer, which is insanity. They need to put more money in funding research
Wow.
for women's health, because right now, a lot of the conditions that I mentioned to you, there are no cures, because we don't know why they're happening. So until we figure out why exactly these things happen, we're not going to be able to cure them. And for some of them, the cure is removing the whole organ, the whole womb. That's a cure. Why should that be the cure? It shouldn't be, because you're removing a whole organ which sits in place, and it sort of helps. I mean, it's there for a reason. As soon as you remove it, it will have an impact, and that's where you get potential prolapses and all the other complications that come with it. Obviously, for some women, taking the womb out is a massive, like, oh my God, you changed my life now. I'm so much better. And that's great. But we need something that is not a massive operation. Well, now it's not as big, because you can they can do it laparoscopically, but depending on the type of hysterectomy that they do. But still,
I mean, I read a book called Unwell Woman. I'm not sure if you've heard of it before, but they describe how we used to, with female patients, attribute all of their ailments to the wandering womb. It just coming up and causing a problem in your head, and then it will come back over here and give you some hip pain. So we've come a way, but you're definitely right in saying, and I didn't even know these things as well. So I think maybe education, not just for patients in general population, but in medical school as well, would be really beneficial. And the last question I had for you was, in 10 years from now, what would success look like for you on a personal or maybe general level?
Success? Good question. I think success would be majority of people knowing the basics about gynae health or women's health in general. So, and I mean this from school age upwards. I don't want to hear stories. I don't not want to hear anyone dealing with painful, heavy periods as normal. I don't want them feeling dismissed or not listened to. And I feel like success is more awareness within the whole population, which then could save lives. Because even when we think of some of the benign, I hate that word, benign conditions, they're trying to change that, which are non-cancerous. Yes, they're not cancer, and yes, they won't immediately cause death, but you are stopping people from living. I remember a quote from my dermatology. I was first year med student, so this is going back 20 years, 20 plus years, 21 years actually. I was a med student, first year med student 21 years ago. That's showing my age. And it was a dermatology lecture, and he said that, dermatological conditions don't necessarily kill you, but they do stop you from living. And I think that's basically it with a lot of conditions. Let's remember that even though technically, they don't immediately or they don't cause death, they stop people from living. And there's a difference between living versus existing. Like, yes, you're alive, but what are you doing? What can you do with the
Are you
illness?
surviving or?
Are you thriving? You should be able to thrive. It's not just about existing in this world. So, yeah.
That's really massive. Well, thank you very much for all of your insights today. I wish everyone could have a talk with Dr. Sese, to be honest with you. I think it would be
Thank you.
beneficial for everyone.
Oh, thank you.
That was really inspiring. And yeah, you can find her work at Talks with Dr. Sese on YouTube, Instagram. But this has been the First Cut, where medicine meets the real world.
Keep shining. Your questions were all extremely insightful. Some really caught me off guard, but
Yeah.
well
Thank
done.
you.